piece of wire. By the time it gets to the device you're powering, you know, it's very often that it's down to 12 volts.
The cable is the most important thing. Yeah. Depends what you're wiring. Yeah, because the car's running the radio, the air conditioner, and everybody uses a certain amount of amperage. So it's got to be there if you want to use everything at once, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's that factor as well, but just it wouldn't give you the voltage drop. The voltage drop is from the inherent resistance of the wire carrying the power from the power supply to the load. What you might have, the problem is that your power supply only is capable of a certain amount of current, and if you have a lot of other loads drawing the current, then you're going to have a decrease in the amount of current available from the battery or the alternator or what have you, power source.
Yeah, that's right. It's definitely the wire. Yeah, you got to use the right gauge wire. It's not gonna happen.
Yeah. It's the thickness of the gauge and also the length of the wire. If you can keep your wire short, that will limit the amount of resistive loss, voltage drop due to resistance. So keep them short and use thick wires. You know, I've seen some guys who put together hi-fi systems where it's almost ridiculous, the thickness of the wire. I mean, I doubt that their amplifier is capable of pushing that much current through their speakers, and yet, you know, they use really thick wire, and sometimes they connect them parallel. So that's a curious thing that some guys do. I guess better safe than sorry is their slogan.
These guys specialize in that stuff. I don't have the amplifiers in my car, but the regular radio. But I've seen that people do that. They use this really thick battery cable wire, and then they reground their engines, they reground everything in order to get the current going. They run a lot of current. I seen a guy, he grounded his engine came with, you know, a little copper strip for the ground, for the frame of the car, and he changed that to a really thick, heavy wire, because he's got a heavy amplifier.
I don't know how those guys hear as they get older. I'm sure most of them go a bit deaf as the years go on, because of the amount of decibels that they expose their eardrums to, you know, especially very often they close the windows to get the full sound. So I'm surprised they don't blow out their eardrums.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You know, I see. I don't know if they're real or fake. I think they're fake, but you know, it makes the car shake. It looks like the car is bending physics. Some videos that I've seen with that stuff.
Yeah, these guys also love to use multiple subwoofers in their car. Again, I don't know. Probably it would cause pain for most people, but you know, I guess they enjoy the pain.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Gump.
Yes, Sam.
Here's the next challenge for you. You know, I got a valve bang UV25 from Radio Oddity with the points I had from buying something from them, and it came and it was defective, so I sent it back after a lot of nonsense, and they sent me a brand new one. Well, I've been charging the battery for 3 days, and I don't think it's taking a charge. Any thoughts on that issue?
Well, unfortunately, if you got a bad battery, you got to contact these guys again. I'm sure they'll be pleased to hear from you and ask for a replacement. I mean, unless the charger is malfunctioning. It's either the battery or the charger. So do you have anything that looks identical to the charger? I think you have another Baofeng someplace, do you? Because that would be a way of checking to see if the charger was the problem. It's either the charger.
Well, I tried to use a voltmeter to see what the current was. Unfortunately, it has a USB-C connection, so I don't know how you use a voltmeter to check the voltage in a USB-C plug. Any thoughts?
No, that's kind of problematic because you're going to have to go through electronics, and you don't have the schematic, and I don't have the schematic. Because, you know, I mean, it might just be a complete feed through that the 5 volts or 5 volts just goes into the charging chip and it powers it up, or it could be something completely obscure. So I don't think there's any simple way of reverse engineering a C connector with 100% surety. You know, you could look at the pinouts of the 5 volts, and you can try that if you feel adventurous. But most likely, I would just contact them and ask them for another battery. Hopefully, they'll send you another battery. And if that doesn't work, then you know the charger is broken.
Okay, well said. Anyway, I'll work on that. Thank you. Thank you, George. Thank you for taking the time to look into the problem, and I am working on that solution as you suggested.
Okay, very good. Sam, I wish you good luck as always. This would not be the first case of an inherently dead battery. You know, the quality assurance, again, is not the greatest when it comes to Baofeng. So I hope it's just that, because it'll be the easiest solution. You know, again, it might be the charger, because that's been known to happen occasionally. When you plug it in, does the charger light up?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so it's more than likely that it's the battery, but let me know how it turns out, Sam.
Well, I will. The battery itself has, like, the red light, and that comes on, but it never goes off.
Okay, yeah. Well, I know. It'll be interesting to see. Again, probably the battery or the intelligent charging chip. Sometimes those aren't working quite right. So, but, you know, it'll appear the same as if the battery wasn't going to take the charge. So we'll see what happens.
Let you know. Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, have a good evening. I'm standing by listening to more conversation.
Okie doke, this is AC2GS with the Limar Technical Net, and we're still open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, hit that push to talk and ID yourself. AC2GS, definitely a slow night tonight, Labor Day and all. Well, as per usual, you know, if there aren't any questions, if there aren't any topics, if there isn't anything to be had, we'll just move ahead with all alacrity, and it'll just be a somewhat shorter version of the Limar Technical Net. But just in case there's someone who wandered by and turned their radio on and has a question or a comment or a topic, we'll kind of give them an opportunity to ID themselves. So if you're out there and you got something for tonight, then please hit that push to talk. Okay, don't want to kick a dead horse. So we'll just kind of move on to the next thing. Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Okay. Before we do, have you heard of a radio called RADTEL, R-A-D-T-E-L, the RT-920 walkie-talkie? Have you heard of this? Back to you.
I remember seeing it someplace, but I don't remember much in the way of, is that the LTX type of radios?
I'm not sure. I spoke to the fellow in California. He just bought one of these, and he paid like under $60, so I assume it must be a Chinese company. Whatever, it gets VHF, UHF, and actually it's 220, and then a couple of the other bands. So you could receive AM, and you could actually receive CW. It's supposed to be a lot of things. NOAA radio, of course, but he's talking about it, and he hasn't transmitted on it yet, but I never even heard of the company. Glad you did. I looked it up, and it was called the RT920 that he got. Must be one of these guys that buy everything that first comes off the shelf or something. I don't even have a Baofeng. Never mind one of these things. But it's amazing, that these things are coming out so inexpensive. Next time I talk to him, I guess he'll have a report about it. They don't even use the frequencies when they talk about it. SW, MW, LW, AM, single sideband, CW, receive CB, 10 watt out. Maybe they're competing against the other Chinese radios. Back to you.
I brought it up on the computer. It's $56.
I have a RADTEL.
Oh, how do you find it? There are cheaper ones. I'm looking at their website. They have a package. They have a product. I think it's called the RT910B. They sell two radios for $62.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Yes, Sam.
I have the RADTEL 880G, and its capability is quite amazing. You can listen to all the bands. It has a separate antenna connection for it, as well as operate, as was said, on all the ultra-high frequencies and high frequencies as well. It's a really good radio. I'm still learning how to use it, but its capability is quite extensive. The ADG.
Oh, okay. I mean, they also seem to be selling DMR radios, although I don't know anyone who uses a RADTEL DMR. And some of them are really cheap. The cheapest one I could see here is $52 for a DMR radio. I haven't seen a DMR radio for anything like that. They have a slightly more expensive one at $125. I would definitely guess that this is a Chinese manufacturer. For all I know, it could be the same factory that generates the Baofengs, because there was a lot of that going on five or six or seven years ago when Chinese handy-talkies first came out, where a lot of them looked very similar to each other. The fact that these guys advertise them as handy talkies strikes me as that they're not really kind of designed for semi-professionals. I'm glad that Sam has one and it works nice for him. But it's probably something along the same lines as a Baofeng. How heavy is it, Sam? Because the Baofengs are very, very light.
I'm lifting it up right now. It has a very good feel. It's not super light. This one's a $100 radio, by the way. And it has three lines, like three frequencies. So you go from frequency A to frequency B to frequency C. And it's very well made. This is a quality product, but it's $100.
Hey, C2PM?
Yes?
Just wondering if the kind of the purity of the output has been tested. A lot of those radios are known to splatter all over the place.
Yeah, my guess would be no. I mean, probably the first place you would find that out would be to search in YouTube. And, you know, there's usually a clever engineer who kind of spoils all the fun by showing you the junk that some of these things put as output.
Yeah, Roger. I bought one of the Baofengs that was offered by, I forget who, but they added a board with additional output filtering, and it cleans up the spectral purity. QSL.
Oh, that's nice. So who does that?
AC2P. I want to say it was Radiodity, but I can't be 100% sure. I'm reaching over to grab it right now. It was the GT5R, Gulf Tango 5R, and I've measured the spectral purity of this, and it's definitely meets FCC standards. It looks just like a Baofeng, but and I have other Baofengs that I don't really use, just around here for frequency generation once in a while for test purposes.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. Good to know. One of these days, probably over the next week, I'll do a YouTube search and see. Someone must have tested it. It seems like a sure thing, but again, I've never really seen much of it on YouTube, but then I don't kind of hover over all of the ham radio stuff on YouTube.
Shocked, I'm sure. Anyway, back to that. Have a good night.
You do. Anyway, with that said, I guess we'll move back to SpaceNet Report.
Okay. This guy was in L.A., by the way, and they have these self-driving cars. And I told him, I said, what would happen if you took that radio and got into that and transmitted it? He goes, that's a good question. You know, those things have tons of electronics all over it. Now, what's going to happen to the self-driving car?
I don't know. I wouldn't tempt fate if I was him.
Yeah, and then I had to hear the speech about the repeaters in there in L.A., how the, it's like the worst type of thing you could hear with, it's not like New York. So he doesn't even bother with it. And I'm like, what are you going to do with this radio?
Well, to give the West Coast its due, so some of the repeaters, like the Papa Network, are very nice people, smart people, well-spoken people. I have heard the other type, though. I was sort of amazed to hear them. They curse a mile a minute. They keep talking about drugs a lot and taking drugs and how to take drugs and, a lot of things that I didn't expect. This one station on the West Coast had an EchoLink connection. Some poor kid from down south tried to have a conversation with them, and they treated him terribly. I felt so disgusted. But, yeah, the West Coast is a different place entirely. But they're not all like that. Just some repeaters are just real lowbrow.
Yeah, I remember bringing up those repeaters years ago on a scan. I had the capability to dial into those repeaters, before EchoLink and all. And I couldn't believe what I was listening to. I said, well, to each his own. Anyway, yeah, if you want to do the Space Network report, we can do that, George. This is WS2N.
Yeah, might as well.
Okay, I don't actually have all that much. Last week, on Sunday, we were supposed to, I was going to listen to the Starship takeoff, you know, SpaceX was going to launch their big rocket. I was going to listen to it at the same time as listening to this net, but it was scrubbed. They had a ground problem. Wasn't the rocket. So they delayed it a day or so, and then they had weather problems. Anyway, last week it did get off the ground on Tuesday. And it successfully launched. That's all the reports, anyway. I watched a couple of reruns of the launch itself. And I did have a couple of problems with the launch, but overall it was successful. They have 33 engines that came on. It looks like one went out. They claimed that they did that on purpose. They just wanted to see how things were going to go if one was dead. Another report I heard was that wasn't the plan. So anyway, they have 33 engines, each one producing over around 500,000 pounds of thrust, and lifting this monster 40-story building really off the ground. It's around almost 400 feet tall. If you put it, I think I mentioned last week, if you put it next to the Statue of Liberty, you know, from the ground, including the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty, it would still be another 100 feet, almost 100 feet taller than the crown. So it's a big rocket. And that's, you know, with the two stages. Let me drop it. The first stage was designed, in this case, to come back and land in the Gulf of Mexico, which it did. In the past, like I said, this is number 10 test. In the past, they've had three of them that have come back to where it took off, and they've caught the stage with these big arms. They call them chopsticks, and successfully have done that with three of them. But now it looks like they've given up doing that for a while. They're doing other tests, but to do those tests, like I said, with the engine out scenario, they're purposely bringing them down right above the water, and then they just let it crash into the water and let it blow up. The second stage took off after the first stage separated. There is a ring in between the two stages that's not planned on being reusable. That massive ring, you know, flew back and wound up crashing into the Gulf as well. But the first stage was done. They considered that a success. Second stage continued on. They wanted to do two important tests before coming through the atmosphere. One was supposed to have a successful flight in a suborbital flight, and the idea was not to put this thing into orbit just yet. The reason for that is this thing is like 220 feet long and 27 feet in diameter. They don't need this thing flying in orbit and then find out they can't get it out of orbit and have it come down willy-nilly somewhere in the future. You know, it would be like a Skylab adventure, you know. When Skylab was done, they did not reboost the Skylab. It just came back down, and they said, well, let's hope it doesn't do any serious damage. And they wound up off the coast of Australia, and actually did part of it did hit land. they don't want a recall of that. So the goal is to refire one of the engines while it's, you know, on the suborbital flight. Which they did do that. They did reignite one of the six engines on the upper stage. Bottom stage has 33 engines. Top stage has six. Three standard engines and then three vacuum engines. In other words, they're designed to work in a vacuum. They get more thrust with these bigger nozzles sticking out. So one of the engines did relight on purpose, which is good because the next time they launch one of these, maybe they will try to put it into orbit. They have not been able, of course, been able to do that yet. The other test that they wanted to do was to see if this door would open up on the side of Starship. And if you were to look at a Starship standing up, the door would open up on the side. They call it a Pez dispenser. So similar to what, you know, you had when you were a kid. This thing would open up on the side and deploy satellites. They didn't want to put real satellites on board because in case they blew up like they've been blowing up, they don't want to waste satellites. So they had these dummy satellites, half a dozen of them on board. And that turned out to be a success. The door opened successfully, and then six of these make-believe satellites wound up being put into orbit. And they'll eventually deorbit. You know, again, the whole thing is on a suborbital flight. So, you know, if you don't touch anything, it's coming through the atmosphere eventually anyway. So these make-believe satellites aren't going to be stuck in orbit. And then the most important aspect of the was to see if they can bring Starship through the atmosphere. Remember, this is supposed to be a reusable system. So that worked out where it did come through the atmosphere. That brings up the part, like I said in the beginning, I saw burning pieces coming off this satellite as it was coming through. They had many, many cameras on board, and you could see some parts of the Starship near one of the flaps was melting. But it stayed functional. I mean, it did make it through the atmosphere. And eventually came down near the Indian Ocean. It's not too far off the coast of Australia. And sure enough, toward the end, the thrusters, you know, it had little nitrogen thrusters come on, push the vehicle from the horizontal position to the vertical position, and they reignited the engines, three of six, and it slowed it down, and then they hovered right above the water, and they said that they hovered around 600 feet above the water, just to see how it would be, and then they dropped it into the water. I think they did that on both the booster and on this one. This one didn't look like it hovered that long. It just turned and then came down vertically. And then they blow it up. I think it's purposely set to blow up. They don't want, you know, large pieces floating around, so now they wound up with a lot of debris in the ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. So with that being done, they're putting together number 11, and who knows when that's going to fly. I don't know yet. And I have a feeling that they're still not going to put it into orbit yet. They want it to do other things. But one of the goals is, once they do get it into orbit, is to actually bring Starship all the way back to where it took off from and have that thing be caught by these big arms, just like the booster. But I think they're a long ways off from doing that. They need two launch facilities completed to be able to do that. Because if one of them catches the booster, you know, they're going to need another one to catch the Starship. So we'll see. Any comments or questions? This is Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Nothing heard. I think Frank said he was going to be away. I usually leave enough time. Comes in on Echo Link from Philadelphia. But, yeah, nothing heard. Anyway, there was another flight up to the International Space Station, a cargo flight. I think it's around the 33rd or so flight that SpaceX has done to resupply food, clothes, scientific equipment to the ISS. And this thing docks to the space station autonomously. Years ago, they used to have it berthed to the space station. There's a difference between berthing and docking. Berthing is they go through a wider diameter port on the space station. And the robotic arm grabs a hold of the cargo vehicle and slowly brings it into place. And then they have these 16 5/8-inch bolts that all are motorized and pulls it in tight, you know, for the there's a gasket system that they have, a couple of gaskets. And that's the berthing system, which was good. For some reason they did away with that. You were able to bring in larger things, let's say a larger piece of scientific equipment, because they had a 50-inch wide capability to bring stuff either in or out of the space station. And, you know, many years ago they did away with that system. And they went with the same docking procedures that the crew vehicles do. The crew vehicles use the docking system where they come up. And nowadays it's all automated. They can fly it in manually if they like. But it goes right up to the NASA docking collar and automatically docks to it. And then they can bring, you know, cargo in that way. But the downside there is they only get, you know, it's like 1 meter, you know, roughly 39 inches in diameter instead of the 52 some odd inches with the berthing system. And they, you know, spend the next month or two unloading things. You know, like I said, clothes, food, and scientific equipment for all the astronauts. There's standard 7 people on the ISS now. And that's your normal amount of people. Sometimes they have more, but usually not less. You know, when they have more, that means, you know, another crew went up, and they're probably relieving the other crew once they're up, then the other crew comes down. They're usually going up 4 at a time and coming back 4 at a time. And they stay for 6 or 7 months. So they need a lot of these cargo vehicles, and there's a number of them that supply the space station. One is this Dragon cargo that we're talking about. Another one is by Northrop Grumman. It used to be Orbital ATK, but Northrop Grumman bought them up. And they send up the Cygnus cargo vehicle to the space station. Cygnus, it's the same idea. You just bring up cargo, not a crew. You know, again, they unload everything. The difference between the two spacecraft is Dragon will take stuff back that they plan on bringing back, you know, scientific equipment to Earth that you know, might be blood tests or, you know, stuff that they have on the space station that needs to go back to the scientists on Earth. The Dragon vehicle, you know, comes back, lands in the water. By the way, they're landing now in the Pacific Ocean instead of the Atlantic Ocean. For a reason I can tell you later. But the cargo from the Dragon now could be brought right away to the scientists. Cargo on Cygnus is a one-shot deal. It goes up, docks to the space station, unloads everything, and they put everything, things that are going to be all burnt up, you know, real trash and everything, into the Cygnus, and then that thing separates or unberths. That's one of the ones that use the berthing system, and then eventually deorbits and burns up in the atmosphere. And Northrop Grumman has sent up quite a few of them in the past as well. And they have multiple ways of launching. They started off launching on the Antares rocket from Virginia, from Wallops Island. And they did that for quite a few years. And they decided that they needed a new Antares rocket. Antares was using the old RD-190 engines from Russia, and because of the problems with Ukraine and Russia, America decided, well, let's get rid of these engines. We need new engines. So they fought back and forth which company was going to be able to supply engines for Northrop Grumman. I thought eventually maybe they would go with Blue Origin, but they decided to go with Firefly. So Firefly is in the process of developing a couple of big engines for the new Antares rocket that's being developed. And I think that might be ready within a year or so. And that will, again, start launching from Wallops Island in Virginia. And, again, that will be launching. One of the things will be Cygnus cargo vehicles. But Cygnus has the ability to launch on different vehicles. So they've gone from Antares to Atlas, the Atlas V built by ULA, United Launch Alliance, which is it's a deal Lockheed and Boeing got together around 2006 or so, and decided that they would work together on the Atlas V rockets. And sure enough, the Atlas V was able to bring up Cygnus to the space station a couple of times. And, you know, they have a big manifest, so they needed another rocket to be able to do the same thing with the Cygnus cargo vehicle. So they launched Cygnus on the Falcon 9 as well. And that's gone up a couple of times with them. Elon Musk thinks nothing of doing that as well. So Cygnus has really never stopped, even so their primary rocket was no longer in use, but will be again, I think, within a year or so. Another cargo vehicle that keeps going up on a regular basis is from Russia. It's called a Progress vehicle. Countless times they've gone up to the space station with that thing. And that docks to one of the ports on the Russian side. The Russians have four different ports that they could attach vehicles to, either manned vehicles or cargo vehicles. And we have four, too, on the American/European side as well. We have four docking ports. four ways of connecting to the space station has. So, let me see if I timed it out. I guess not. And then of course there's one more that they that will be used again. I talked about this last week. It's being launched by Japan. It's called the HTVX, HTVXL. HTV has launched 9 separate times over the years, usually once a year, to the space station to supply cargo and science batteries and God knows what else from Japan. And that was always very successful. That brought up the most cargo per flight. And I talked about it last week. They're building a new one. It was called the HTV. Now it's called the HTV-XL. And that will be launched, I think, late this year. They have their own rocket now. Well, they did back then, too. They had the H2B, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, medium to heavy lift vehicle that Japan has or had. They had the H2A, H2B. H2A launched all their science and exploratory missions to the moon and Mars. The H2B only launched the cargo vehicle, the HTV, to space station. And now, of course, we have the HTV set to be launched on the new H3 launch vehicle from Japan. You know, years ago, there was another cargo vehicle that went up 5 different times. So you can see that there's been a lot of them. That was the ATV, they call it, from European Space Agency. They did that part in the early days of the space station. That was a very big cargo vehicle. They said attached to the Russian side of the space station. And they had so much fuel on it, they would use that quite a bit to raise the altitude of the space station. Space station, remember, will eventually start to deorbit over time. You know, you think it's in a vacuum, but there's little molecules up there, so it's rarefied air, you might say, and it tends to slow the space station down, especially a big space station. Over time, it would start to, it actually starts to get lower in altitude. Every now and then, they need to reboost it, so... In the early days, they used the ATV. That would not only bring up cargo, but it would give the space station a terrific boost, get into a much higher altitude. They'd be able to stay there for a longer period of time. HTV is to launch on the Ariane 5 rocket. Now Ariane 5 is retired, and now they have the Ariane 6. But yeah, the ATVs are no longer used. But they went up 5 different times. And the United States loved that design so much. European Space Agency built it. They loved it so much, they decided to utilize that design for the Artemis program. You know, going to go back to the moon in April with a crew of 4. And years ago, NASA said, you know, we need a service module. And NASA is really into international cooperation. So they signed on the European Space Agency to build the service module for the Artemis program. They have Artemis, you know, being built by Lockheed, crew vehicle itself, Orion. But then behind that, you need a service module to supply power, you know, electricity, you need water, fuel, that's what service modules do. If you're older, you remember the old service modules from the early days, from Gemini, and, well, Mercury Gemini, and of course the Apollo missions. And it's been really good cooperation. Glad to see that's still in operation with the European Space Agency. And that thing is ready. And all I have to do is put all these components back together again. Starting to assemble things now in Florida. So we'll have that, hopefully, first flight around the moon and back by a crew since 1974. We had Apollo 17 was the final mission to and from the moon. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report. Okay. Nothing heard. There are quite a few launches in September. There's your generic flights from SpaceX. There's actually going to be six more Starlink flights going up. Each time they go up, they put up dozens of these satellites. They've been doing this now for years. I think they just went over their 7,000 satellite mark. And every week it's always a launch or two. Well, this September you're going to have the first six launches from, will be from SpaceX putting more of these satellites, into orbit. But I'm more interested in the other couple of flights that are going to be going up. You have NG3. That's on the 15th. That'll be another, a cargo mission. You have IMAP going up. IMAP is a flight that a science mission that will be going to the L1 location, Lagrange Point 1. And that'll be stationed there. Lagrange Point 1 is a million miles away from the Earth, four times the distance away from, than where the moon is, but in the direction of the sun. And IMAP will be, looking for everything that comes off the sun. We have a couple of them out there now. The Discover is still out there, and SOHO is still out there. They're in that location. And they go around the sun, every year. But they don't really go around the Earth. But Earth and Moon, Earth and the satellites follow around the sun at the same time. So anytime you're looking at the sun in that direction, if you could see it, you'd be looking at a couple of those satellites that are sitting there in the L1 position, no matter what time of year it is. So those satellites pick up signals from the sun, all the science that's involved with it, and they transmit it back to Earth. And you don't have to worry about relay stations or anything. As the Earth turns, the Deep Space Network picks up those signals. You have three main locations for the Deep Space Network, and they have probably a dozen satellite receivers that are involved. Actually, transceivers. They transmit data to the satellites as well. And they're located around the Earth, set at 120 degrees apart. So at any time, these satellites are constantly transmitting data back to the powers that be here on Earth. And they're going to be joined by IMAP in the month of September.
we'll see how that launch goes. And then there's the Atlas. It's called the Atlas KA-3 launch. That'll be on the 25th of September. Atlas rocket is ULA's biggest rocket right now. Actually, not the biggest now. Now they have the Vulcan, but most used rocket. Now over 100 flights. And Atlas has taken two flights so far of these Kuiper satellites. This is going to be number three for them.
Question.
Question. Hey, I'm not alone. Yeah, go ahead. This is WS2N.
This is Alpha Echo 2 Yankee Golf, Sam. Could you describe what these satellites kind of like look like? Are they all similar in size and weight? Or can you just talk about satellites a little bit to give us an idea of what, you know, is going up there?
Okay, Sam. Yeah, they're, it's weird. The Kuiper satellites that are being launched for Amazon. You know, that's going to be their broadband satellites. And Atlas is launching 27 of them each time they go up. And each one, I think, is around a little over 500 pounds, you know, like the weight of an old piano, you know. So they're quite heavy. They have, you know, by the way, there's no actual pictures that Amazon has produced yet of what the satellites actually look like. The ones that SpaceX have up there, the Starlink ones, you know, they know pretty much what they look like. You know, they all have solar panels and things. And the new Kuiper satellites by Amazon are similar. They have, you know, when they open up, they're going to have solar panels. And they also have thrusters, ion thrusters. So when they're put into space and they need to go up, you know, another 100 miles from wherever they were left off, the ion thrusters come on and they'll fire for, you know, days or weeks at a time, whatever it takes to get them to their proper orbit, which is a good design. Not, you know, no chemicals involved. And another good design with both Starlink and with Amazon Kuiper satellites is if they fail, and SpaceX has had a lot that failed, the same thrusters come on to deorbit them so they don't get stuck up there for years on end. So they'll slow down, they'll pick up more resistance, and eventually they'll deorbit. So, of course, then they have the electronics on board. You know, they have a phased array. I've seen a picture of what the SpaceX one looks like. And it looks like a flat panel. And it's designed to be able to actually change locations that it's looking at, you know, when it's looking at Earth. They also have the capability of talking to one another. So let's say Starlink is going overhead, they can transmit back to another satellite, you know, after it leaves its location, and those satellites could then transmit down to the different ground stations that they have set up, or directly to a user on the ground. Come on in, Stan Kuiper. It's really going to be depending on those ground stations. They're building them around the world. For those things to link up with them.
So they only have right now 102 satellites in orbit right now for Kuiper. But now they'll have another 27 once this KA-3 Atlas thing I was talking about that's going to launch on the third week of September. They'll have another 27. So each one's around 500 pounds, that type of thing. The Vulcan rocket, which is ULA's newest rocket that's flown successfully three times now, much more powerful than the Atlas V rocket, therefore can carry much more payload. They'll be able to launch, I read, 45 Kuiper satellites for Amazon. So they get, more bang for their dollar for that. They have on Vulcan, I think it's 36 flights or something that are planned just for these satellites. Their goal is to get over 3,000 satellites into space to become operational. I think they need 1,500 before they can really consider themselves operational, but then they're going to shoot for a little over 3,000, which is really good, for them. I don't know if we're going to be able to see the stars anymore with all these satellites. I was going to say something else about the... Oh, yeah, they also contracted out with European Space Agency on the Ariane 6, the new Ariane 6. That's a heavy lift vehicle that they launched from South America to launch quite a few of these satellites at a time, too. So, yeah, I don't have a picture. I haven't seen a picture, and there's actually been reports about it. How come we don't see any pictures of this? I guess they don't want to give away their secrets. I'm not sure. I guess eventually we'll see what the actual satellite looks like. Back to you, Sam.
Thank you very much. How do they avoid collisions with each other? I mean, I heard the expression space junk. How launching all these satellites, is there going to be a higher probability of, outer space collisions? Back to you.
Yeah, it definitely increases that possibility. But there's supposed to be, there's a control room in Washington State that SpaceX has. I believe that's where they're tracking them. Probably also doing it in Hawthorne, California. But yeah, they're monitoring where all these satellites are at one time. But on top of that, they have to monitor where all the satellites are, they're given certain locations, certain heights. I think the Starlink by Elon is around 325 miles above the surface of the Earth. Gives you an idea. Space station is at 250, so it's like 100. I don't know, almost 100 miles higher than the space station. And then the new ones that are going up by Amazon, these Kuiper satellites, are higher, around, I think, 350, 375 or something like that. So they're going to be a little higher location. There's another one out there called OneWeb. They have 600 satellites up there now, and they're at a much higher altitude. I think they're around 600 miles up. And, I wonder if they have collision avoidance. if they see another one coming at them, I haven't read that yet. They're all being tracked, and if they see something that's there, they can turn on their ion thrusters and move one way or the other, I guess, to avoid, collision. Back to you, Sam.
Just give me a moment. I was never aware that Amazon was actually in the satellite business. Do you know what their intention